Greetings and reinventions, my fine listeners, and welcome to this January 2013 Science News Update. I'm your host for this first science podcast of this freshly minted annuum, Jim Campanella. Welcome to my monthly bit of insanity. Let's go right to the heart of the stories. Listener Paul Hauser wrote in to me with the following question. Dear Jim, I have a physics question about gravity on planets with more mass than Earth. Astronauts simulate zero-g in water. I assume that buoyancy is responsible. How would that work on a 2G planet? Would I sink or float? Thanks. As I told Paul in my email response, I'm not a physicist, but this is what I believe is the best answer to the question. Buoyancy in liquid has to do with the relative density of the liquid and what you have floating in it. It doesn't really have anything to do with gravity. Density would not change as gravity goes up 2 or 3-fold. Matter that can flow is called a fluid. Now, fluid does not mean the same thing as liquid. Liquids and gases are both fluids. Under the right conditions, solid matter that's made of small particles can also flow. The ground shaking during an earthquake, in fact, can turn soil into a fluid. And when that happens, cars and other solid objects can actually sink into the ground, which you've probably seen on a few really bad movies. A scuba diver uses a buoyancy control device, a BCD, to sink or float in water. To sink, a scuba diver releases air from the BCD to decrease their volume. This reduces their buoyant force and makes them more dense. To rise to the water's surface, they have to become less dense by increasing their buoyant force. So they increase their volume by filling the BCD with air from the scuba tank. They can stay in one place underwater if they have neutral buoyancy. That means that they have the same density as the water around them. A diver can be neutrally buoyant by controlling the amount of air in their BCD, just like a training astronaut can. I don't believe that that relationship would change as gravity goes up, because it doesn't really have anything to do with gravity. It again has to do with the relationship between the density of the liquid and the density of the body in the liquid. If I'm wrong on that, I'll be happy to hear the email corrections by any physicist who is out there. Okay, here's the first actual story of the night then. I came by it in a rather confusing way. I first found the article myself early in the January issue of the journal Science, and I read the work by Dr. Ulrich Schneider at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. And I think I did not entirely understand it, because I got a particular conclusion from it that apparently other people did not. The reason I say I didn't entirely understand it is because listener Mark Zanfardino wrote to me to recommend what I thought was an entirely different paper with a different goal and conclusion, which, well, it actually turned out to be the very same paper after I went back and read the link that he emailed to me. If I had understood my first reading of the paper, I would have immediately known that they were one and the same. And interestingly enough, the paper was then immediately recommended to me by 3 other listeners, C.J. Urso, Mike Bernecki, and Michelle Demi. And I thank all 3 of you for your recommendations as well. Apparently, this is a very popular paper. Anyway, why am I so confused about what paper I was reading and what exactly is it about? Well, from what I can tell, Dr. Schneider's work really entailed 2 major breakthroughs. I really only recognized 1 when I first read it, which led to my misunderstanding, so let me explain. The paper has to do with temperature and our understanding of what temperature really is and what it means. We recognize everyday temperatures as those which we deal with as the most important molecule around us changes. Water. Water boils at 100 degrees Celsius and it freezes at 0 degrees Celsius. And in some sense, that defines our environment. A negative temperature on the Celsius scale just means a temperature below where water freezes. For example, my laboratory freezer is at about minus 20 degrees Celsius. A really cold laboratory freezer, where we would store things like tissues, RNA samples, protein samples for long-term storage, would be minus 80 degrees Celsius or less. At that temperature, most biochemical activity has pretty much completely ceased. There are other scales of temperature measurement that are used by physicists. and they do not base their scale on biological activity or the state of water. The chief one of interest here is the Kelvin scale. Zero on the Kelvin scale is absolute zero. That is minus 273 degrees Celsius. That is the temperature at which atoms have completely ceased their movement. And that is an important definition of temperature because up until this point, temperature has always been defined as a measure of molecular movement. The greater the movement, the higher the temperature. Each of the molecules buzzing around in a pot of boiling water, for example, has more energy on average than a sluggish water molecule in an ice cube. Mark and the others wrote to me about this story because we have previously discussed absolute zero and the heat death of the universe, and everybody seemed to think this was related to that. The important point that Mark made about the Schneider article is that Schneider's research group is the first group ever to get a negative Kelvin temperature. A negative Kelvin temperature was thought to be impossible because it is a lower temp than absolute zero. So how do you get a negative temperature when the molecules have already stopped moving? Dr. Schneider set out to do something unusual. He wanted to get the particles within a substance to be confined to a very high level of energy. In other words, instead of having the particles start at a minimum energy corresponding to absolute zero, and spreading out toward higher energies, he wanted to start at a maximum energy and spread toward lower energies. By definition, a substance under those conditions would have a negative Kelvin temperature. His team achieved that with potassium atoms chilled to a few billionths Kelvin above absolute zero. Through the use of lasers and magnets, he managed to get the atoms to jump to a high energy state. By creating a cluster of particles exclusively at high energies, Schneider and his colleagues had a gas at a few billionths negative Kelvin. The temperature is technically not below absolute zero because negative on the Kelvin scale, unlike that on Fahrenheit or Celsius, is a complete construct that simply indicates something about the energy state of the particles involved. And that was the point that Mark wanted me to get out of the article. Negative temperature, weird quantum effect, weird energy state. And now here is where I got confused. I understood the article, when I first read it, to actually be about getting the hottest temperatures ever recorded. Well, it turns out that due to the weird energy state, you also have another odd phenomenon occurring. Schneider's new creation, besides having a negative temperature, is also extremely hot, because of the high energies of the particles involved. Schneider says, quote, "Heat travels from hot to cold, and heat will always flow away from this gas. It's actually hotter than everything we know," unquote. I don't understand this either. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around that statement. It's near zero Kelvin, and yet it's hotter than everything we know. How does this make any sense? Well, Schneider tries to explain it as follows, quote, "The high-energy atoms in the system can't lose energy because doing so would require them to increase their kinetic energy. That is not possible because the system is in a vacuum and there is no outside energy source to interact with. We create a system with a lot of energy, but the particles cannot redistribute their energy, so they have to stay in a high-energy state." Unquote. If you define heat as molecules being in a high-energy state, then that's why the molecules are so hot. They're locally restricted to that high energy state. If that isn't weird enough, here's another statement from Schneider, which made my head spin even harder. Quote, "The molecules in a typical gas spread out and exert a force on the walls of their container. But a negative temperature gas also has a negative pressure, meaning the particles tend to cave in rather than expand. It wants to collapse into a single point," unquote. Yes, negative temperature gases want to implode. And no, I don't know how that can be exactly either. Schneider suggests that negative temperatures are important to study because dark matter may have negative temperatures, leading to negative pressure effects. He says that experimenting with the quantum phenomenon of negative temperature could reveal the nature of dark energy throughout the cosmos. You know, every time we bring up quantum mechanics and quantum phenomenon in this program, I feel like I need a drink, or an aspirin, or both. Oy, my head. Next story. As a martial artist of many years, and an evolutionary biologist, this next story fascinates me. If you ask most evolutionary biologists what forces caused humans to evolve with their hands in the shape that they are, they would do hand waving and talk about grasping tools and making tools and the selective need for fine manipulation. However, if you ask Dr. David Carrier of the University of Utah that same question, you will get a very different answer. Carrier published an article this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology that suggests a very different selection process that caused human hands to develop as they did in a very different way from any other ape. Carrier suggests that the human hand may have evolved its distinctive proportions for a far less enlightened reason than simple tool using. It was for use as a weapon. According to Carrier, modern chimps have long palms and fingers with a short thumb, while the human palm and fingers are much shorter and the thumb longer and stronger. Carrier explains that this squat arrangement allows us to clench our hand into a fist when we fold the thumb across the fingertips. However, chimp fingers form an open donut shape when curled, according to Carrier. So Carrier hypothesized that the tightly packed human fist provides internal support, that is, buttressing, to the digits to protect them from damage during combat. In addition, he wondered whether curling the fingers into a fist could allow the delivery of a more powerful blow, that is, increase the peak force of an impact, than slapping with an open hand. Carrier tested to find out whether hands are more effective when balled into a fist or wielded in a sort of slap. Carrier asked athletes to smack a punching bag with their hands in a range of shapes, from open-handed slaps to closed fists, using various delivery styles, overarm, underarm, sideways, head-on. And Carrier measured the peak force of each impact. He found that the punch did not deliver more force per blow with an open palm. So the hypothesis that the closed fist delivered more force than any other shape found no support from that initial experiment. So he then followed that experiment up and tested whether buttressing the hand by curling the fingers and thumb stiffens the entire structure of the hand. Martial artists were asked to roll their hands into a variety of fist shapes. For example, two of those shapes were with the thumb extended sideways. And then push the first joint of the index finger against a force transducer to measure the rigidity of the knuckle joint in the presence and absence of the buttressing thumb. Impressively, the knuckle joint was four times more rigid when supported by the thumb. When Carrier measured the amount of force that the athletes could deliver through the fist surface of the index and middle fingers, he found that the presence of the buttressing thumb doubled the delivery force by transmitting it to the wrist and through the metacarpals, that is, the palm bones, and then through the thumb and index fingers. So our short, square hands are perfectly proportioned to stiffen our fists for use as weapons and allow humans to deliver powerful punches without incurring much injury. Well, the next story sticks with that theme of evolution, but it is way, way more controversial than what shaped human hands. The Quarterly Review of Biology came out last month with a very interesting story from Dr. William Rice, who is an evolutionary biologist at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Dr. Rice has been tackling a question that has been puzzling biologists now for more than a few years. And the question is this: evolutionarily, why are there still humans out there who are homosexual? Let me put this in biological terms before somebody screams and gets upset. Biological selection occurs from generation to generation as organisms reproduce. The interaction between the environment, the physical traits of an organism, and the likelihood of that environment to affect reproduction all interact to produce evolutionary change over time. Humans and apes, for example, no longer have tails because they stopped living in trees and simply don't need those tails. And there was likely a reproductive disadvantage to having those tails. Therefore, over time, apes with shorter and shorter tails were more reproductively successful until apes were left with no tails at all, including humans. If you have a trait that is a reproductive dead end, that is, individuals with that trait do not reproduce, then how is it that that trait is selected for or passed along to new generations? And the answer is, it's not usually. So we have a paradox. How do we have individuals who have a trait that is essentially a reproductive dead end? Rice suggests a radical reevaluation of how homosexuality may be genetically passed along. He suggests that the molecular underpinning of human sexuality, including homosexuality, could lie in the inheritance of epigenetic markers. Now, let me make this clear if you guys don't remember. Epigenetic markers are those that are not included in the coding of the DNA itself. These are sort of metagenetic control systems. Rice's paper provides a step-by-step argument for this idea. The theory is not yet backed up by actual epigenetic data on people with different sexual orientations, but, at least right now, it relies on established findings on the frequency of homosexuality and the known mode of inheriting epigenetic traits to make its case. The crux of Rice's theory is that in the womb, sex and sexuality are influenced by levels of testosterone. But this isn't just mediated by whether a fetus had male or female genes that control the level of testosterone production. Epigenetic markers on the genome also control how the fetus, and then later the child and the adult, respond to testosterone levels. Most male fetuses have epigenetic markers that make them more sensitive to testosterone than female fetuses. Usually, the male epigenetic markers are erased from the egg and sperm and reestablished in a fetus. But Rice's team argues that when male epigenetic markers are not erased from the sperm and are inherited by a daughter, or when female epigenetic markers from an egg are inherited by a son, sexuality could be influenced. The change in the fetus's reaction to testosterone is not enough to change their sex, but it could be enough to alter their sexuality. I actually saw an article on Yahoo this week that claimed that Rice's new findings nixed the idea of a quote-unquote gay gene. Geneticists have not believed, by the way, for a long time that a gay gene exists. A trait as complex as sexuality is not likely to be controlled by one single Mendelian gene mutation. Geneticists have realized for a while that lots of complex traits are never controlled in such a way. Height, weight, intelligence, skin coloring, all those traits have gradations that are controlled through complexes of interacting genes. It still may be that multiple genes will have to be examined to get the whole story, along with the potential epigenetic effects. In short, Rice's work certainly does not close the book on the biology of homosexuality. Even Rice says that discovering epigenetic markers is just the beginning of our understanding of a very complex genetic effect. Okay, on to a less controversial story. Loud noise is bad for you. There you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, I told you this piece would enlighten you. Loud noise, bad. Okay, I'm kidding. Well, I'm not kidding about the loud noise. Loud noise is bad for you, and it can cause permanent damage. Industrial workers, even musicians. In most cases, when there are destructive sound waves, those waves focus their energy on the small hairs of the inner ear in the cochlea. Those ear hairs quiver in response to sound and send the sense of those sound waves to the brain for interpretation. As those hairs are destroyed, permanent hearing loss is the result. Well, here's the entire point of this story that I was getting to. There now may be hope for people, famous and otherwise, with hearing loss and tinnitus. Dr. Albert Edge, an otologist at Harvard University Medical School, was the lead author of a paper in Neuron this month, which reports the first time that a drug has been applied to the inner ear that seems to regenerate those ear hairs. The drug works by activating a DNA transcription factor involved in hair cell development. The finding is the first in the field. While fish and birds can regenerate inner ear hair cells after sonic damage, scientists have never been able to show that that's possible in mammals. Dr. Edge explains why this is a breakthrough. Quote, cochlear implants have been available and successful for years and have helped a lot of people. But there's a general feeling among clinicians, scientists, and patients that a biological repair would be preferable to an implant. Unquote. Previously, Edge had shown that inhibiting a protein called Notch from signaling during mammalian development in mice was important for hair cells to form properly. In this new work, he tested whether such inhibition of the Notch pathway could also spur hair cell regeneration in adult mammals. First, he tested different inhibitors to determine their effects on isolated ear tissues. This allowed them to pinpoint one, the alpha secretase, LY411575, and that led to increased expression of a number of molecular markers found in the hair cells. Edge says that they were completely surprised by the results. They had few expectations that the treatment would affect an adult mammal. All their work had initially been done with early development, and adult tissues are hard to stimulate to grow. Then the scientists tested the inhibitor in mice with hearing damage and reduced hair cell populations caused by exposure to loud noise. As far as I know, they did not use Justin Bieber music, which would have just killed the mice outright. Anyway, they tagged cells in the inner ear to follow what eventually happened to them and discovered that the drug caused the supporting cells to differentiate into replacement hair cells. Those replacement hair cells partially restored hearing at low frequencies of sound, although not at higher frequencies. The effect lasted for at least 3 months, which was as long as they tested. As with all studies like this, there could be a potential problem with the treatment. It may not work in people like Pete Townsend, who damaged their hearing decades ago. The drug was employed in mice 1 day after damaging sound waves were introduced to them. In other words, the damage was fresh. Because the damage was fresh, the Notch protein signaling was probably at its highest. Therefore, it's possible that a small window of time exists after an acoustic injury in which the drug must be given to be effective. Old schmucks like me may be out of luck. Edge finished the paper saying that since the hearing improvements they saw were modest, they were now going to look at variations of the approach and whether they could use the same drug to treat other types of hearing loss. The final story of the evening is a new one about academic, scientific dishonesty. The story was just published today in the online news section of the journal Biotechniques. Dr. Paul J. Mukowski, the former senior investigator at the Gladstone Institute of Neurological Disease, he resigned last month, today issued a formal apology for having falsified data in 3 grant applications submitted to the National Institutes of Health. Mukowski said, quote, I would like to express my sincere remorse and apologies to the community. I now fully realize that any shortcuts in drafting grant applications are wrong and not acceptable scientific procedure. I will never commit such mistakes again. Unquote. He will probably never do them again because he will probably never get another job again, I suspect. Even making stuff up on an official government application is tantamount to an academic death sentence. He will be lucky, in my opinion, to get a job teaching high school biology in Arkansas. The U.S. Federal Office of Research Integrity says that, quote, in 3 grant applications, Mukowski falsely reported from research experiments when the results did not exist at the time the grant applications were submitted, unquote. Mukowski has been a prominent figure in the field of Huntington's chorea disease research, and is the author of several papers that have been cited over 100 times each. In a paper published last year, 2 years ago now, in 2011 in the journal Cell, Mukowski reported that a new compound, which they call JM6, alleviates neurodegenerative symptoms in mice who have Huntington's chorea and Alzheimer's. Mukowski says, quote, "Importantly, my research findings were never called into question, and there will be no retractions based on these findings," unquote. Yeah. And my response to that is, well, no retractions so far. I would be very surprised if the ORI doesn't start looking at his publications as well. The government does not appreciate it when you take their money and then make things up. As a result of the ORI's findings, Mukowski has agreed to be supervised for the next 2 years on any federally funded research project in which he's involved. In addition, he will not participate in any advisory roles in public health service. Why do I bother telling you these types of stories? Well, in short, to remind you that scientists are just like people in other fields. Do not trust results just because they were published somewhere. There are good scientists, untrustworthy scientists, and just plain rotten scientists, just like any other endeavor. Some of them cheat, lie, falsify information, mislead, etc., just to be more competitive, to get tenure, to get promotions, and to get laud from their colleagues in some cases. The victims of the actions of these tricksters are often other scientists who act with the utmost integrity, who get passed over for grants because other colleagues and their imaginary work look so much more seductive and sexy to the grant committee. Worse than that, it affects our children and our children's children, who will have to live with those wrong or ill-thought-out science papers in the future. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care, don't lie on grant applications, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.